everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on antique firearms when we return. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this class includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of the alleged crime and what you should say to the police or investigators and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself and your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, and rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and shut up. Now, after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. For more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. And best of all, it's free of charge. And courtroom strategy and procedure is also available on compact disc for adult home education. Now, if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about prohibited persons and whether or not they can keep and bear arms. We took a look at the Commerce Clause, Hale versus Hinkle, Wolf Company versus Industrial Court, and we find that these 25,000 rules, regulations, customs, usages, and practices that have been superimposed upon the Second Amendment are in fact rules of commerce. And when you deal in commerce, you can be regulated and controlled. Congress has not interposed itself between you and your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Congress has properly regulated the buying, selling, trading, and use of firearms used in commerce. If they're not used in commerce, they're not regulated, and we saw that in a case decided in the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals just a couple of years ago. Now, the last item that we need to cover here is ammunition. And the ammunition is tricky because ammunition is also regulated just like the firearms themselves. So we have commercial firearms and we have antique firearms. And then we have nine classes of persons who are prohibited from having commercial firearms, but they're not prohibited from having antique firearms. Then we have all the rest of us out here. We can have antique firearms or we can have commercial firearms. Remember those two classifications. You have commercial firearms, those that are manufactured after 1898, and you have antique firearms, those that are manufactured prior to 1899, that is 1898 inclusive. Now, the ammunition can be a problem. The same statute, 18 U.S. Code 922G and U.S.C. 924E, that outlaws prohibited persons from possessing modern guns, also prohibits them from possessing ammunition for modern guns. And a man up in New England just got 20 years for possession of a single 9mm cartridge. Now, the statute and the ATF's implementing regulation, Title 27, Code of Federal Regulations, Section 178.11, defines ammunition as, quote, ammunition or cartridge cases, primers, bullets, or propellant powder designed for use in any firearm other than an antique firearm, unquote. All right, now that's a pretty important definition. When you buy an 1880 Smith & Wesson 38, back in 1880 they didn't have smokeless powder. So when you use ammunition for this antique firearm, the only difference between smoke powder and smokeless is that one is pretty smoky. So don't use the modern powder, use the old-timey powder. Now you've got these modern cases. Notice here that it covers cases, bullets, everything that's manufactured in commerce. Again, this commerce clause is very tricky, and this is one you got to master. Because if you screw up on this one, they got you. And any time that you're dealing with the courts, it's the strict construction of the statute that counts. And the government is going to strictly construe the statute. And when you come in there with some lame brain defense like, well, I didn't know, or I bought it at Bass Pro, well, it was my 1880 antique gun, I didn't know that there was antique ammunition, or, then you get burned. So let's go on and listen to this. Now, there is no problem for muzzle loaders. The ATF concedes that muzzle loader paraphernalia is without question designed for use in none other than antiques. But when it comes to ammunition, that is cartridges, even obsolete cartridges, the ATF legal counsel takes the position, which has never been upheld in any published court decision, but they take the position that designed for use really means merely suitable for use or otherwise usable in a post-1898 gun subject to ATF controls. All right. Now, what we would do with a case like that, we would take it in for declaratory judgment. You could sue in federal court for declaratory judgment, and the federal judge would look at that regulation and construe it for you. Now, if you're one of those persons who is on the prohibited list, that's probably not for you. It would probably be more logical for you to just follow that regulation and presume that if you've got a cartridge that can be used in a 38 caliber, then it can be used in a post-1898 38 caliber. It's prohibited to you. That's why unusual ammunition, for instance, I got an Egyptian army rifle in here. It's a 30 caliber, but it's some kind of an odd 30 caliber. Like, it's not a 300, and it's not a 30-06. It may be a 303 or a 309 or something like that. It's out in left field. Now, that's not an ordinary cartridge. That's not something that you're going to find in commerce. So you take a gun like that and then reload those shells locally so that those shells never go across state lines. Listen to this. For example, the ATF has administratively ruled that 50 caliber Remington Army centerfire cartridges designed for use in antique Remington rolling block pistols is modern ammunition because it is shootable in currently made Sharps replica rifles chambered for the 50-70 U.S. military rifle cartridge. Now, that position is ridiculous since pistol cartridges are not designed for use in rifles chambered for a different caliber cartridge. But, like it or lump it, ATF ruled similarly for 32 caliber and 38 Smith & Wesson black powder loaded center fire cartridges, even though such custom-made cartridges are obviously designed for use in antiques only. Now, this administrative ruling has not been tested in court. Since modern revolvers made since 1899 that chamber these cartridges, use smokeless powder rather than obsolete black powder, this writer believes that they may not constitute ammunition under the federal law definition. All right, I'm going to put a little editorial comment here. That may be true, but who wants to take the risk? If you're on that prohibited list, you risk prison time. So, again, to be on the safe side, you can simply call ATF, as we've discussed before, and ask them. Then make sure that you double it by getting it in writing, in case you ever have to defend it. And if you're in doubt, just leave out 32 and 38 Smith & Wesson and go back to the cap and ball pistols. All that means is that you're going to load it yourself in the pistol. That's all. Going on, they say that with respect to current factory-made standard rounds loaded with modern smokeless, not black powder, such as 22 rimfire, 32 Smith & Wesson and 38 Smith & Wesson centerfire, 7mm Mauser, 12-gauge shotgun, 30-40 Krag, etc., all of which are designed to be used in both pre-1898 antique and post-1898 guns of those calibers, the ATF classification as modern ammunition is probably correct. For example, the standard 30-40 Krag centerfire ammunition, currently manufactured by the big ammo makers, is designed for use in all 30-40 Krag rifles, not just pre-1899 antiques, but also modern Krag rifles made between 1899 and 1903. So that leaves that gun out of the potentials for the 9 classifications of persons, because the ATF has ruled on that. So, again, you can't be concerned about, well, can I buy cheap ammunition or can I get the kind of gun that I want? You're going to be limited to the antique firearms from 1898 back, and those that are of an odd caliber. Not something that you can use or that's likely manufactured and used in commerce today. For instance, I mentioned, I think in the last program, a 3240. I happen to have a 3240 1872 Buffalo gun. Well, that's such an odd caliber, and you can get them reloaded locally. They're not used in commerce, and the gun is an antique. So that's the type of gun that, you know, common sense would declare that you'd probably be better off with, rather than try to use a 38 caliber, which can be either an antique or a modern weapon. Now, obsolete rounds, that is, various sizes and weights of lead bullets actually fired, are a different story. The DBI books, Cartridges of the World, lists, describes, and gives the history of hundreds of obsolete rounds. This author is currently asking the ATF to classify about 100 obsolete rounds as antique ammunition. Thus far, the ATF has conceded that prohibited persons may possess 58 U.S. musket centerfire, 58 caliber carbine centerfire, and 43 Egyptian Remington centerfire, because their extensive research has not found any post-1898 guns or replicas that chamber these rounds. All right. Now, here's an example. 58 caliber, 43 caliber are so unusual, and I mentioned that earlier, that the 3240 or some other antique round of ammunition, something that's not even manufactured, and then reload it. From your perspective, what do you care whether you're firing a 58 or a 45? that's irrelevant. And don't be concerned about the price of the ammunition or the ready availability of it. And none of these guns are usable in a phallic symbol way. I was talking to a guy the other day, and he said that he wanted an AK-47. And I said, well, what would you do with it? He said, well, I'd take it out to the range and shoot it. Now, you know, when I was a boy growing up, my dad explained to me that a gun was a tool. A gun is a tool like a hammer or a saw. And you use it to accomplish useful, meaningful, and purposeful work. Now, you know, we Americans are kind of peculiar people. We go out and spend thousands of dollars, and we buy things, you know, like exercise machines, and we go to gyms to work off all of our fat. We want to work in air-conditioned offices, because we don't want to earn our bread by the sweat on our faces. And then we spend thousands of dollars to buy these expensive exercise machines to do just that. Now, have you ever heard of somebody going down to the local carpenter's board nailing range and just driving nails into boards? I remember when I was a little kid, about 5 years old, I wanted to learn how to drive nails, so I found a can of nails and a hammer, and I went out on our boardwalk, and I started driving nails through the boards. And I probably drove 100 or 200 nails. They didn't do anything, they just went through the board. But I learned how to drive nails when I was just a little kid. Now, I suppose if you need some practice, going out to a target range is probably a place to learn how to use a gun. But once you've learned how to use the gun, the question arises, as a tool, what are you going to use it for? Now, a framing hammer makes sense when you're framing, and a finish hammer makes sense when you're finishing. But you wouldn't want a framing hammer just to be driving nails and boards, would you? So it would seem like to me that if you wanted a gun, it would be a tool that you would want to use for something. Are you going to use it for hunting? Are you going to use it for self-defense? Are you going to use it for shooting varmints? Now, I've got a special varmint gun here that I shoot prairie dogs with. And I shoot coons and possums, and then I have a gun here for shooting. I got a 12-gauge shotgun that I use for shooting cows when I'm butchering. So, you know, here on the ranch, we have several guns that we use for different purposes. And there's none of them used here for a phallic symbol. I've got a pickup, but I don't need it because I need to show you that I'm a redneck. It would seem like to me that a Corvette makes all the sense in the world in San Francisco or New York. I can't imagine a Corvette here on the ranch any more than I could imagine a Humvee in Manhattan. But, you know, people want to drive Humvees and they want to drive SUVs, but I can't see the logic behind it. So it would seem like to me that if you're looking for a tool in the form of a gun and you're one of these prohibited persons and you're going to go the antique firearms route, the logical thing would be to get one of these firearms that definitely, without any crossover, that no one could then later say, well, you're using this .58 caliber, which is a common round of ammunition used in interstate commerce, when in fact it is so uncommon, you could only get it reloaded at your local reloader shop or reload it yourself. I mean, just common sense tells me that. All right, going on here, they say, incidentally, it took a lawsuit to force the ATF to concede in writing that the .43 caliber Egyptian Remington round was an antique, and the threat of a lawsuit to compel concession regarding the other two calibers. As for the rest of the obsolete calibers, it remains to be seen if the courts will publish a decision upholding ATF's absurd usability interpretation of the phrase designed for use. Now, it seems unlikely that a federal criminal trial jury would. I will disagree with that. Juries will almost always follow the prosecutor's recommendation. I wouldn't trust that at all. And in fact, in my experience, I think that you'd be better off to stay away from the factual elements of the case, stick strictly to the legal elements, and rely upon a bench trial to have the judge construe the law. That's why if you're following the law and you're within the bounds of the law, then there aren't any factual issues to argue. You just waive a jury trial, walk in and say, "Judge, here's the law and here's what I did. Here's what I'm following." And your defense will come out in your favor. You reduce the controversy to a single clear-cut issue of fact and take it to a jury, you'll almost always lose. I would disagree on that point, but then, you know, why do you want to go to trial anyway? The objective here is to stay within the federal and state laws. The trick in all of this is obey all the laws of the United States, all the laws of your state, and all the laws of God, and do it all at the same time. Let me add to this while we're thinking about this thing of law. Wickard versus Filburn, cited at 317 U.S. 111. Wickard versus Filburn. I'll tell you a little story here. Back in the 1930s, during the Depression years, Congress came along with a neat program for farmers. And they were, the market price of wheat was about 50 cents, and so they jacked it up to 96 cents. You could get an extra 46 cents a bushel for your wheat if you'd sign up with the Department of Agriculture program. And here's what the program called for. If you would sign up and voluntarily agree to limit the number of acres that you would plant to wheat, you could get the extra 46 cents. Called price subsidy. So this guy named Filburn goes in, signs up, and he gets a 20-acre allotment, and he plants 20 acres of wheat in 1938, and he sells it, and he gets 96 cents. He's happy. 1939, he does the same thing, 1940 and 41. But about 1942, he decides that he's going to plant 40 acres of wheat. And he does. So he planted 40 acres of wheat, and he sold 20, just like he did in 38, 39, and 40. But he took the other 20 acres of wheat. He didn't sell it. He fed it to his turkeys. Well, when the Department of Agriculture heard about this, they prosecuted him for breach of contract, and this case ultimately went clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. And when it got up to the Supreme Court, the court came back with a very famous saying, and they said, "It's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of the law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes." Now, anytime you get a privilege, a perk from government, government will be right there to regulate and control it. And that's why they give you these perks. They come along and they say, "Well, wouldn't you like to have these price supports?" And they appeal to your vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, or fear. And naturally, human beings are motivated by these five motivators, and we're all greedy, and we'd like to get that extra 46 cents, and so we want to sign up. And then we want to think about and mull over and figure out some way that we can beat the government. And oftentimes people do. But oftentimes people don't. And when you don't, then you go to prison or you go to jail for the violation of the law. It makes you mad. And you say, "Well, what about my rights?" Well, you see, Mr. Filburn gave up his rights when he signed the contract. And you gave up your rights when you signed up for Social Security and business licenses and driver's licenses and marriage licenses, and you signed up for aid to families with dependent children and the PIC program and agricultural subsidies, and on and on and on the list goes. And Americans today have become totally dependent now upon their government, and the government is simply regulating that which it subsidizes. And guns are just one more of those areas of subsidies. And all of the major manufacturers are corporations. Now, you can find some little local guy out here who's not incorporated and that reloads ammunition. You can find some little local gun dealer over here, a gunsmith. He may or may not be licensed, but he's not incorporated, and he can guide and direct you into finding one of these old-timey guns. Now, I don't know what this old Egyptian gun is that I got up here, but maybe it's a 43 caliber, but it seemed to me it was a 30 caliber something. And it's one of these oddball calibers. So you find one of these oddball calibers and you go to your local, and as we read on this story here, we'll find that you can reload this stuff yourself. There are books out there, and it's not against the law for you to have the black powder. You can have the cases for cartridges, or better yet, you can, you know, these cap and ball pistols. The cartridge is in reality a muzzle loader, and it loads right into the cylinder. So those I think, insofar as a handgun is concerned for personal protection, is probably the answer. That certainly takes you right out of ammunition altogether, period. But for a shotgun, you kind of need the shotgun shells. And you're in a bind there. You need some kind of an oddball shotgun caliber that you have to reload yourself, that aren't out there in the commercial world. And then rely on property and property rights instead of trying to deal here in commerce. And this guy's got some pretty good ideas here, and he's also got a number of books that you can buy. You can probably go to any sporting goods store and get these books on reloading or books on odd calibers. And notice they've also pointed out here that you can write right to the ATF itself and get the information that you want on these odd caliber guns. So avoiding the ammunition problems, the U.S. Constitution authorizes the federal government to prosecute only four crimes. However, the Constitution also contains the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, which allows Congress to regulate commerce between the several states and the Indian territories. Now, broadly construed by a Congress and a judicial system, the Commerce Clause has enabled the federal government to enact more than 10,000 federal criminal laws, and then to expand those four federal crimes to include everything from pot possession to illegal campfires. All right? Let's pause here for a moment and think about that. We've been talking about commerce. You want to go into the national forest and you want to camp there. Now, the government went into the national forest and built a road so that you could get in it. They built campgrounds in there, and they put picnic tables in there, and then they put a ranger out here at the park entrance. And he collects $10, I think was the last time I paid, to go into the park. Now, when you get into the park, they're going to have a museum, and they'll have a headquarters in there, and you can go in and buy souvenirs and all these kinds of things. Well, that comes under commerce. And when you buy a ticket to go in there, and then you build a campfire, and the ranger comes over and says, "Now, wait a minute, partner. Here are the rules concerning campfires. Here are the rules concerning camping tables. And here's the rules concerning this, that, and another thing." You know, that's commerce. And you don't have any inalienable rights or constitutional rights involved here. And that's the distinction that Americans have evidently either failed to learn in school, or they've failed to learn it in college. Somewhere along the line, we failed to learn about commerce and rights. And Wickard versus Filburn spells it out. Remember, Wickard versus Filburn, cited at 317 U.S. 111. "It's hardly lack of due process or equal protection for government to regulate that which it subsidizes." So when we sit here and we complain about these thousands of laws that the federal government now is creating and using against us, in every single case, there's a regulated enterprise at the root of it. You don't have any inalienable constitutional right to go into a federal park and camp there. That's a privilege. Now, the government took your tax money and went out there and made these improvements, and they're competing with private campgrounds like KOA. Well, evidently the people of America want that. Now, if you go to a KOA campground, don't they have rules there in the private campground concerning campfires? And don't they have rules concerning where you can park and how much you pay and how you use the showers and what you do there? Now, of course, if you violate those rules, they'll kick you out. They don't prosecute you and put you in prison. But keep in mind that it's something that's done under contract. It's not something that you have this right to. Now, the Second Amendment's a little different. You have an inalienable right, a constitutional right to keep and bear arms. But you don't have any inalienable right to keep and bear commercial arms. And since about 1898, all guns manufactured from that date on are commercial. Commercial. Article 1, Section 8, commercial guns. You don't have any rights to those. It's like riding on an airplane. You do not have any constitutional right to ride on an airplane. Especially when it's Delta Airlines or United Airlines. I mean, that's just where the reality is, and that's where the misunderstanding comes in. Hey, let me give you a reminder here. We're at the halfway point talking about antique firearms. Now, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to the website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. I might give you a reminder here that this article comes from the Anti-Shyster magazine, Anti-Shyster, and it was volume 9, number 1, volume 9, number 1. You can go to the Anti-Shyster website at www.antishyster.com. That's www.antishyster.com. Pretty good article. Let's see what else we've got here. An essential element of proof of the crime of unlawful possession of firearms or ammunition by prohibited persons is the interstate commerce requirement that the illegal possession was in or affecting commerce. This element could be proved by possession during an interstate road trip or even a ride on a common carrier such as a train, plane, or bus. But 99% of the time, ATF proves the commerce element by showing that the gun or ammunition moved interstate after its manufacture. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld this concept. So if the ATF can show that a modern gun made by Colt Industries in Connecticut was shipped to a dealer in Nebraska, even if that transport took place many years ago, and you get caught with it in 1998 or 2005 in any state other than Connecticut, which is the site of the gun's manufacture, then the commerce element has been proved. All right, now, commerce. That's in the Bible. It's called Canaanite trafficking. Canaanite trafficking. You don't have a right to commerce. Commerce is the opposite to private property. Commerce is where we buy stocks. We'd rather have an equitable interest in Ford Motor than we would to own our own machine shop. So we go out and we buy stocks and bonds and we buy mortgages. We go out and we do things like shopping for a mortgage. It's an oxymoron, but then that's the way Americans think. We go out and we shop for a mortgage so that we can enter interstate commerce. When you're renting a house or you're renting an apartment, rent is income. Rent is commerce. It's commerce because you use Federal Reserve notes, or you use banks and credit cards, or you use checks or other forms of negotiable instruments. Now, the scripture tells us, thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag, in Deuteronomy 25:13-16. So we've been told not to deal in this commercial paper. But, you know, we don't follow the laws of God very well, never have. And as a result of that, we have some misunderstandings. Our government comes along and encourages us, entices us, to get involved in trade, commerce, business, and industry that affects a public interest so that they can regulate and control us under the Commerce Clause. If we would stay out of commerce, about 99%, but at least 90% of all your troubles disappear. And I discovered that years ago when I was operating a corporation, and I had problems with OSHA. And I was in court constantly with them, and then I had problems with the EPA and the State Tax Commission and the Department of this and the Department of that and all these various agencies. And so, you know, I couldn't figure out what's happened here in America. The government just came in and just regulates and is just regulating us out of business. Well, here's what the motivation of government is. If the government was a limited government, and it was just working under our Constitution to provide the services that the people need, such as national defense and roads and bridges, there's no money. There's nothing in it for the government officials and the bureaucrats and so on. There's no power. There's no great profit. There's just service. And that's why under the Mosaic Law we had a Levitical priesthood. Today we call it the civil service. That's our Levitical priesthood. It's the civil service. And as a result, government took a look and said, well, look, what can we do to increase our share of power and prestige and profitability? So they started off kind of slow and easy, and they said, well, gee, wouldn't you like to have this or that or something else? I remember up in Boise, Idaho, they came out and they said, wouldn't you like to have an LID, that's called a limited improvement district? An LID, a limited improvement district, is where they come out and put in curbs and gutters. I lived on a street that didn't have any sidewalks, didn't have any curbs, didn't have any gutters. And the street wasn't paved. You know, it was just gravel. Just a road. And so the people, you know, said, well, yeah, we'd like to have that too, just like they have downtown, you know, on Idaho Street in front of the courthouse. And so they had an election. Of course, most of the people voted for it, and so they put in this LID. That's a little political subdivision. And then they put that on your property tax. And they come out and they put in the curbs and gutters and and then pave the street and do all these things, put in light poles so you got lights and they give you all these things that you want. Well, okay. Now that you've got it and you put it in, now who's going to pay for this? And the answer is you are going to pay for this. But it creates employment for the six or seven guys that are on this board of directors of the limited improvement district. And they have to be paid. And they're going to get, this is a job for these guys for the next 30 years. Because there's a bond issue that is called for, and they sell these bonds, and then some insurance company buys them, and you have to pay for all of this. And so this is a little power play on government here. Gives you another level of government. Now, if you don't pay these taxes, they'll come in here and take your house and sell it on the courthouse steps. You're pledging your property as collateral for this limited improvement district, putting in the curbs and gutters and street lights on Denton Street. And they have hundreds of those all over Boise, Idaho. And you can vote against them, but most of your neighbors are going to vote it in. And then you're in the city, so that's a municipal corporation. So that's commerce. So if you're living in a city, you're a commercial man. If you've got a social security number and you're working for some corporation, you're a commercial man, getting paid in dollars, dealing in commerce, unjust weights and balances, and you're practicing theft. And Americans have been doing it for a long time, and we don't see it that way, and we're very happy with what we've got. And then we complain a lot. You know, when the ocean inspector comes in, we complain about him because he doesn't have a search warrant. He doesn't need a search warrant. I thought he did. And the guy that came into my factory, I picked him up and threw him out in the street physically. Needless to say, my relationship with government's never been quite the same since. And now I understand the law a little better, and I said, geez, you know, I went out and incorporated my company. I signed the contract, you know, like Mr. Filburn did over here, and then I didn't follow the rules. And then I got real mad because I thought they were violating my constitutional rights, of which I didn't have any constitutional rights, but I thought I did. I thought I should have. All right. Now, when you involve yourself in commerce, when you take your gun, put it in your car, and you drive over to the neighboring state, you're involved in interstate commerce. And now you're in trouble. So if you've got this gun and you've got these, you know, this muzzle loader, these cap and balls or whatever you've got, or this odd ball ammunition that you're using, you've got to make sure that you buy it in your state, and, or that you load it in your state, and that you use it in your state, and that you don't move it across state lines. Because the minute you move that thing across state lines, there's interstate commerce. And you're going to sit there and say, well, that's not right. Well, I don't know if it's right or not. I'm just telling you that that's the way the law is, and that's the way the game is played. And if you're one of these prohibited persons, you don't want one of these 9mm cartridges in your car. You don't want anybody in your car that's going to have modern firearms, because if they leave behind a cartridge in your car and you get caught with it, then you're the person who's in possession of it. And they regulate the bullets just like they do the guns. And it's all done under interstate commerce. And listen, they've got some pretty stringent penalties for violating commerce. For instance, if you wanted a fully automatic Uzi submachine gun, assuming you're not one of the 9 restricted persons, just an ordinary run-of-the-mill Joe six-pack, you go down to the IRS and get a tax stamp and you can go out and buy one of them. They've got them for sale all over. If you go into a registered gun dealer and tell him, I want an Uzi submachine gun, here's my tax stamp, he'll sell you one this afternoon. So all we're talking about here is money. But you know what most of these guys, and you guys want this phallic symbol, you want a fully automatic gun. I can't for the life of me figure out what in the hell you're going to do with it. The only purpose for those fully automatic weapons is to kill people with. And we've already got a law that says, thou shalt not kill. I can't for the life of me figure out why it is that Americans are so enamored with these fully automatic weapons, it's my Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Well, then you got to go back before 1898, because that's a modern commercial weapon, and you're not entitled to commercial, got that, commercial guns. I mean, that's just where the law is, and that doesn't violate your constitutional rights. So that's the way that game is played. Now, one way for prohibited persons to legally circumvent federal gun laws is to... Now, that's an oxymoron. Legally circumvent federal gun laws. Wait a minute. If there's a gun law that prohibits prohibited persons from having a gun, well, then you're not going to circumvent that law. The correct way to word that is, for these nine classes of persons to keep and bear arms, which is their constitutional right under the Second Amendment, they have to divorce themselves from commerce and practice private ownership of property. These prohibited persons are not prohibited from keeping and bearing arms. They're prohibited from keeping and bearing commercial firearms. Now, I'm in that boat in regards to commerce as it relates to my school. I am prohibited from engaging in trade, commerce, business, and industry affecting any public interest. When you come to school here, I cannot take your check. I can't take your credit card. Because if I engage in checks and credit cards and commercial paper and stocks and bonds and things like that, then I become commercial man. So I have to deal in gold and silver coin. I have to deal in wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. I cannot deal in banks, securities, stocks, mortgages, and other commercial instruments. And if I do, then I'm going to be regulated and controlled. I got a letter here some years back. In our state, they call it the Bureau of Vocational Education. And so to regulate and control all schools in the state enacted this law. Now, there's private schools, and then there are public schools. Now, most people think of a public school as being a government school, and that's not true. All schools are public because they're open to the public under the Commerce Clause. And if I operated a school under the Commerce Clause, I too would be regulated and controlled by the Bureau of Vocational Education. So I wrote him a letter back and I said, this is a private school, we're not open to the public. They seemed to understand that, and we haven't had any further communication. Now, that's the way it works for me in the school business, and that's the way it works with you if you're one of these prohibited persons. Everybody in America has a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Most Americans can keep and bear arms in a private capacity or a public capacity. But if you're going to bear arms in a public capacity in commerce, then you're subject to the 25,000 gun laws that go along with it. Just like you are when you go to the national park and you pay your money and you go into the national park. Now you're subject to all of the rules and regulations of the park system. And if you don't want those rules and regulations imposed upon you, stay the hell out of the national parks. That's what I do. I don't do business with government, and because I don't do business with government, I don't have a problem with government regulation. Most Americans cannot live without government regulation, because you have to have the government services. Americans have been converted from private individuals under Hale versus Henkel to a corporate capacity under regulation and control. You did it with your own hand. You're the one that signed the marriage license. You're the one that signed the application for the driver's license. Don't complain about the highway patrolman regulating you in a commercial venture on the public highways with a driver's license in your pocket. That's just where reality's at. I didn't make it that way. I'm just reporting it to you. So when we use this term, thus one way for prohibited persons to legally circumvent federal gun laws is to possess ammunition or modern firearms for that matter that have never moved interstate. Why don't we word that? In order for prohibited persons to keep and bear arms under the Second Amendment, they must stay out of commerce. They have to make sure that they have never moved this gun or this ammunition interstate. For those who live in the same state, says the big ammunition makers like Winchester, Olin, Remington, Peters, Federal, Hans, and so on, this is not a problem. So if you live in Connecticut and you're buying the ammunition in Connecticut, it's not moving interstate. But, wait a minute, aren't you one of those prohibited persons? And you're going to fire this ammunition out of one of these commercial guns? When I read that paragraph right there, I got a little nervous, and I said, no, I don't think I would do that. Even if I was one of these prohibited persons, and I lived in Connecticut, I would not buy that ammunition in Connecticut and fire it in Connecticut. I think I would stay away from any gun, any ammunition that isn't genuinely antique. I mean, why run the risk? Why take the chance? I mean, after all, if you have been barred from or prohibited from, you know, George Gordon is barred from and prohibited from trade, commerce, business, and industry affecting a public interest. I understand that. I avoid it like AIDS, herpes, and VD. I have many people call me and say, well, how can I open a bank account without a social security number? Who in his right mind, without a social security number, would want to open a bank account? I thought the objective was to get the hell out of commerce. And people call me all the time, well, how can I participate in commerce without a social security number? It's like the guy saying, well, how can I have a fully automatic machine gun? Well, you go down and get a tax stamp. Well, then I would be regulated by the government. Well, okay. That's what the purpose of the program is. It's to be regulated by the government to pay your taxes. All right, going on here, he says, first, you can order a list of federally licensed ammunition manufacturers in your state from the ATF's disclosure branch for $25. So why don't you get a list of in-state commercial reloaders? I like that, commercial reloaders. They must also be licensed or therefore on the ATF's list of manufacturers to minimize the ATF regulation. You might acquire your ammunition from such an in-state source and be sure to never let it move in interstate commerce. You know, the Bible says that you ought to avoid even the appearance of sin. Another way to minimize the ATF regulation is to make your own ammunition. There are books on the subject, such as Duncan Long's Homemade Ammo and Ronald Brown's Homemade Guns and Homemade Ammo. Homemade ammunition that has never moved interstate does not violate federal law unless possessed on a common carrier or during an interstate road trip. Don't go jump on a Greyhound bus now and go over to Arkansas or some other state. Just don't move your homemade ammo interstate, or ATF fanatics might claim that you designed them for use in modern firearms, even though you made them for and are using them in an antique shotgun. So watch your six. Research and thoroughly understand your own state's law before making any action concerning antique guns or ammunition. Many states use federal firearm and ammunition definitions verbatim, but they exclude antiques. Others even count BB guns and marine distress flares as firearms. So a call to your state's attorney general's office or your local gun rights organization should help you clarify the situation. Under federal law, you can have any muzzleloader and its ammunition. Under federal law, you can have any cartridge gun made before 1899, except machine guns or sawed-off shotguns. However, ammunition for antique cartridge guns is a stickier problem. So, to get around that, those odd calibers, solve that problem. Stay away from 22s and 38s and 38s and 45s and get off onto 58 and 43 and 303 or something else. And remember, to violate federal law, it must be a firearm or ammunition as defined in Title 18, Section 921, and Title 27, Code of Federal Regulations, Section 178.11, plus the firearm and or ammunition must have moved in interstate commerce. If it's not a firearm, an excluded antique, or if it was homemade or came from an in-state source and never moved interstate, then you can confidently tell the ATF that you're not breaking the law. Now, remember, we pointed this out to you with this guy that had manufactured a gun in his basement, and then the state came in and said, well, no, wait a minute, you're in violation of the law here. And the guy said, no. Well, the appeals court took a look at it and said, no, I'm not in violation. Watch commerce here. A federal appeals court Thursday overturned a Mesa, Arizona man's federal conviction of possessing 5 machine guns. Now, this guy's got 5 machine guns. He got caught with them, and he's prosecuted and convicted. But a 3-judge panel of the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco reversed the conviction, ruling that the congressional ban does not apply to homemade machine guns and their parts because they were never in the stream of commerce. Got that, commerce? So this author here hit the nail on the head in this article published in the Anti-Shyster. Let me give you that name and address again. It's called the Anti-Shyster Magazine. Anti-Shyster is at www.anti-shyster, S-H-Y-S-T-E-R, it's all one word, .com. AntiShyster.com. I want to give them credit where credit is due. I didn't write the article and I didn't do the research, so I'm just a reporter, but it sounded like a pretty good story to me. And so I thought I would report it to you. And while I was at it, I thought, since I get so many calls, so many inquiries, so many complaints about the Second Amendment and how government is interfering with our rights. And it's true. You know, prior to 1900, the government didn't interfere with our rights to keep and bear arms. We weren't involved in commerce. But government woke up one day and said, well, gee, can we suck all these people into commerce? And if we can suck them into commerce, we can make a lot of money, and we can create bureaus and agencies of government, like the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the IRS, and OSHA, and the EPA, and, you know, they got all these agencies out here to regulate and control us because we want the benefits that government offers. And there's no free lunch. So if you get rid of the benefits, you stop doing business with government, and you get rid of all of your licenses and contracts with government and start living your life and support yourself for a change instead of living off of the public dole, you won't have any more problems with government. Your Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms will never be a problem to you again, even if you're one of those classifications of 9 restricted persons. Well, we're just about out of time, so I'm going to have to cut it off right here. We'll take up another topic tomorrow night. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, just call The Law School at 417-273-4967. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Time's up. See you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, good night, friends.